Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome to Ruination, the early years. I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
And joining me, as always, is my expert guide through the glorious and highly specific chaos of Big Fatty Online.
It is definitely glorious chaos. And today we are strapping in for a very, very revealing deep exploration into the BFO archives.
We really are.
We're focusing on one intense 5-day period that I think just perfectly captures Big Fatty's formula.
Which week is that?
The week of May 19th through May 23rd, 2008.
Okay, so that's Big Fatty Online, episode 77 through 81. And what a week. You are so right. This single stretch of shows is like a perfect encapsulation of the BFO universe.
It really is. It's where you see the high stakes, but, you know, often fictional personal litigation narrative just collide violently with this deeply intimate generational discussion of aging.
And it all happens while he's maintaining that foundational BFO structural anchor that keeps the whole thing from flying apart.
Exactly. And for anyone who might be, you know, dipping their toes into the early BFO content for the first time, or maybe just needs a reminder of the structure,
right.
Big Fatty Online is a daily weekday show. He's hosted by Big Fatty, who often calls himself the fat one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's built entirely on his core mantra, this self-aware declaration of his brand identity, which we hear nearly every single day.
It's not just ruined. It's me, Big Fatty Online.
That's the one. And that ruined part is so critical. It's basically permission to be imperfect, to be chaotic, and to be utterly, completely unfiltered.
So our mission here is to synthesize the key events, the personal confessions, and all the surprising details from his life this week. We're going to trace the full arc.
Okay.
We start with a wild late night weekend recap. Then we deal with some intense, but let's be honest, imaginary legal drama.
Right.
Then we move into this profound character reflection on what it means to turn 40. And then, snap, right back to the reliable routine of pop culture updates and listener gifts.
We're basically treating this week as a masterclass in what you could call structured vulnerability.
Oh, that's a perfect way to put it.
It's the BFO recipe, just refined. He mixes the mundane stability of his highly structured routine, the daily show, the predictable segment placement.
Yeah.
With the absolute chaos and explicit detail of his social life and, you know, his declining physical body.
So let's see how he starts the week. Because Monday, May 19th, episode 77, it just hits the ground running with some incredibly intimate disclosures.
It sure does.
Okay, let's unpack this Monday. We start, as listeners would have expected, with the weekend recap.
Yeah.
And Big Fatty delivers his usual quirky salutation.
He does.
Wishing his listeners a weekend that went smashingly or swimmingly or smashingly or fattingly or something like that.
Or something like that. He confirms he had a very fun, relaxing weekend with Miss Kitty.
And it's important to contextualize the setting here, isn't it? He was at the Hura Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
For longtime BFO listeners, that's the affectionate, kind of tongue-in-cheek nickname for the Metropolis Entertainment Complex in Augusta, Georgia.
Right. It's a known spot. It's a known gathering spot for his social circle and the, you know, the broader community he participates in. So the baseline is established. Structured leisure time with a close friend.
That stability is immediately, and I mean immediately, shattered by the intrusion of chaos. The question on apparently every dedicated listener's mind was whether Snake was there.
And he doesn't just give a yes.
He gives
a definitive, detailed, timestamped yes.
He recounts how Snake, without any pre-planning, just, well, ran into him.
Right.
And that led to a very, very mutually satisfying hour together.
The fact that he shares this is notable in itself, but the way he shares it is just pure BFO genius.
Okay, explain that.
Well, he provides the precise time signature for this late night intimacy, Sunday morning between 3:30 and 4:30 a.m.
Why is that specific timing so essential to his whole persona?
Because that level of detail, it elevates the personal confession to like a narrative artifact. Sharing something extremely private with almost journalistic precision is a classic BFO move.
Right. It signals authenticity.
Exactly. And a commitment to the listener. He's not just hinting at a good time. He's giving you the metadata for the encounter. And this commitment to detail is what allows the audience to trust his narrative, even when he introduces fictional elements later on.
I see. But the narrative isn't just about the encounter itself. It's about the immediate physical fallout.
Yes.
The punchline, the element that anchors this whole escapade in his growing old narrative, is his immediate lament afterward. He just states plainly that he is too old for that.
And that phrase is such a pivotal character note for the entire week. It's the constant tension we see in his content.
The desire versus the reality.
Yes, the desire for the chaotic young lifestyle that Big Fatty Online lives, colliding with the physical reality of his age and the, you know, the necessity of his daily, highly scheduled coal mine.
The day job.
The day job. He had a great time, but the physical cost of being up until 4:30 a.m. knowing he has to get up for the show and his job, it immediately introduces the major theme we're going to see on Wednesday, aging.
That tension is also immediately reflected in the show's really bizarre structural opening clip for episode 77.
Oh, yeah.
Usually, BFO starts with a fun clip from a fellow podcaster, sort of a nod to the RNL network.
Right.
But this Monday opens with a segment featuring Connie McCumley. Or, as he instructs us to spell it phonetically, Connie, M-C-O-M-E-L-E-Y.
This is where the narrative drama kicks up a notch, but we have to emphasize, this is Big Fatty using fictionalized litigation as a form of comic storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Connie identifies herself as an airline worker, which ties her to his frequent real-life struggles with travel.
Of course.
And she announces that she cannot elaborate on her situation because she is currently in litigation with the Big Fatty.
It's just brilliant self-generated conflict.
Yeah.
And the source of the feud, alleged slander. Connie claims Big Fatty is slandering me on the nets through BigFatOnline.com.
Right, calling her names and critically accusing her of stealing his bag.
We've seen this before, right? Mm. He takes a previous piece of real-life drama lost luggage, an annoyance that so many listeners can relate to, and he turns the antagonist into this recurring character who threatens to sue him through opening audio clips. It's a very calculated use of tension.
It is. It sets a tone of high stakes, but ultimately fabricated conflict before the actual content even begins. And by doing that, it kind of licenses the real unstructured chaos of his personal life, like the snake story.
So why do you think he constantly introduces these fictional legal threats?
Yeah.
Is it just for drama, or is there something deeper, maybe a commentary on the litigious nature of online interaction?
I think it's a bit of both, but it's primarily a narrative device to build stakes in a show that is, I mean, fundamentally about a man sitting in his basement talking about his life.
The coal mine provides stability.
And the litigation provides narrative propulsion. Exactly. He's essentially saying, my life is so big, so visible that I constantly have people trying to sue me or derail my success.
It feeds right into the ruined persona.
It does. He's a figure of chaos, and chaos attracts legal trouble, even if it's imaginary trouble over a stolen bag.
So moving past the legal dramatics, Big Fatty always makes sure the BFO remains part of the larger RNL podcasting network ecosystem.
Oh, absolutely. That's always there. On Monday, he mentioned making it easier for listeners to access the Gay Days blog, which was created by Michael from the QCast connection.
Right.
He even pointed out that this blog features a photo of Queen Liz for visitors to see. This isn't just promotional filler. It's an act of community building. It's validation.
By directing traffic to his peers within the network, he solidifies his own place as, like, a reliable cornerstone of that whole independent network structure.
He does. And he also reminds listeners of his recurring segment, Ask Mr. Biggs.
And we know this segment is a time-tested structural anchor for him. He frequently reminds the audience that it has been recycling real talk show phone calls since 2006.
Which is fascinating because it grounds his relatively new cutting-edge podcast in a very, you know, vintage media trope.
Right, like an old radio call-in show.
Exactly. By blending old media references, the syndicated call-in advice show, with this new raw podcast format, he appeals to both the nostalgic listener and the person looking for fresh content. It speaks to his deep affinity for classic television structures, which we see again and again in his memory lane music segments.
So then we jump to Tuesday's content, episode 78. Here, he uses this kind of self-deprecating humor to manage his brand identity. He almost defines himself by what he won't do.
Mm-hmm. He makes this humorous deflection, stating that he would never try to sell cookbooks or exercise tapes.
Which is a clear and, I think, necessary distinction to make at that time.
It really was. Early podcasting was just saturated with diet and wellness gurus trying to monetize their platforms.
And BFO is saying,
I am the antidote to that. He's emphasizing that the BFO brand is purely about chaotic honesty and self-acceptance, or at least the acceptance of being a big fat slob again, as we'll hear later.
Right.
Not self-help or aspirational dieting. It defines his anti-guru persona.
And speaking of chaotic content, Tuesday featured the chicken joke segment.
Oh.
This is one of those segments that, on paper, sounds like pure, unstructured filler. Big Fatty literally spent time on air reading various answers to the classic riddle, why did the chicken cross the road?
And doing impressions of how famous people would answer the question?
Exactly.
It is filler, but it's high-quality, entertaining filler that really adheres to his low production value style.
That's a good point.
It's the kind of segment that makes the audience feel like they are just sitting in the room with him, listening to him riff. The impressions and the reading of corny jokes contrast so sharply with the emotional intensity of the aging discussion or the explicit nature of the snake recount.
It offers that necessary moment of levity.
It does. It proves that the show can sustain itself on sheer personality, even when the content is inherently absurd.
And he continues to boost his peers, relentlessly. He spotted a funny picture of Tim Cormall, who he affectionately calls Tim Call an Ambulance.
I love that nickname.
Next to Kim Beaver's links on her site. He urged listeners to go look at this picture, confirming his commitment to the broader podcaster community, even while, you know, gently ribbing them.
That network connectivity is so crucial because Big Fatty understands that his success relies on the health of the entire RNL ecosystem. He's not hoarding listeners, he's sharing them.
And on the same Tuesday, episode 78, BFO also took care of some BFO world logistics.
He did, setting up his internal world structure for his loyal listeners.
Yes, this is always a fun transition. He physically enters the Fat Cave, accompanied by the dramatic Gotham City sound clip. For a new listener, what exactly is the Fat Cave and why is that clip so important?
The Fat Cave is his recording sanctuary. It's the place where the magic and the chaos happen, usually his basement.
Yeah, and the clip.
Using the Gotham City sound clip is a direct reference to the classic Batman TV show, signifying a dramatic entry point into his performance space. It's a piece of performative theater.
It's a ritual.
It's a ritual that says, the hero is entering his lair and the show is officially beginning. His community recognizes it as the show's true start, regardless of what pre-roll content like Connie McCumley's litigation threat has played.
He then provides a crucial update on the listener map.
Mm-hmm.
This map isn't just a technical feature. It's a proof of concept for his community's global reach.
Mm-hmm.
He notes that strange things happen on a full moon, and Tuesday was a full moon, causing the map to load quickly, which he found highly unusual.
Which is just BFO attributing supernatural phenomena to technical performance. It's a hilarious way to engage with the mechanics of his own show.
Right.
And he uses that absurdity to drive participation. He stresses that joining the map is a very prestigious club.
He uses this moment to encourage community participation, urging listeners to get your fat ass over there and join the listener map. The language is simultaneously insulting fat ass.
And encouraging, yeah. Join the prestigious club.
Exactly. That duality, that use of abrasive affection, is the core of his rapport with the audience. The map is proof of the show's reach and the community's active, named, and geographically placed engagement.
It transforms the solitary act of listening into a recognized global presence. And this desire for physical, tangible proof of his community's existence, the map, the gifts, the voice letters, it becomes a grounding force that allows him to indulge in the self-destructive narratives because he knows he has a reliable network supporting him.
Okay, so the centerpiece of this week, though, is the Wednesday show, episode 79. After the initial chaos of sex and litigation, we get this deep, candid, and often hilarious discussion on aging. It's a huge narrative anchor for this period.
It is. Here's where we move from superficial chaos to, like, core character development. This is the second installment of the series Growing Old and Gay, or sometimes Getting Old the Gay Way.
Featuring the return of Auntie Vera Charles.
Yes, who BFO lovingly refers to using a variety of nicknames, including the Old Gal, the Sea Hag, or Verna.
They had previously covered their 20s and 30s, and now the focus shifts to the tumultuous 40s. And what's structurally significant is that both hosts are 52 years old at this time, but they experience their 40s in these wildly divergent ways.
Which provides a perfect dramatic foil. Vera Charles led off the discussion, agreeing that the 40s were generally better than the 30s, on the whole, as she likes to say.
Her experience was marked by career growth and domestic stability.
Right. She paints this picture of mature contentment. She details that she bought a house with Gucci, becoming a homeowner in her 40s.
She describes the decade as nesting, putting down roots, and not being as flighty anymore. Vera's story is this path of organized, structured maturity.
The kind of stability Big Fatty often strives for, but, you know, really struggles to maintain.
And that structure immediately contrasts with Big Fatty's visceral experience. He admits he hated it.
Oh, he hated it.
He couldn't wait to turn 41. He confesses that it was the greatest day of his life when he could just give the finger to my 40th year. He felt that 40 was just terrible.
And the root of his hatred wasn't professional stagnation. It was the sudden, undeniable onset of physical decline.
He started to feel your age immediately. It was a betrayal of the body.
Mm-hmm.
He gives two specific, incredibly relatable anecdotes that capture this loss of youthful resilience. It moves the discussion far beyond just a simple lament.
The first is the stairs incident.
Right.
He recounts tripping up the stairs in his apartment building after coming home from the store, a common, minor stumble. But the difference was profound. He realized he couldn't just hop up like he used to.
He had to sit right back down for a second.
Exactly. Realizing you're not 20 anymore. It's that shock of realization that recovery time is now measured in minutes, not seconds.
And the second anecdote is just as impactful, about his mornings. He mentions his inability to bounce out of bed anymore.
Yeah.
He had to take a second, swing his legs over, and just sit at the edge of the bed before standing up. It's a tiny, mundane adjustment, but it's a constant, daily reminder of lost youth.
These two small stories, tripping on the stairs, sitting up in bed, they synthesize the entire physical theme of his 40s. They are the universal language of aging.
And the ultimate lesson he learned, which he shares with his listeners, was this. Your body is going to tell you no when your mind is telling you yes.
That phrase perfectly encapsulates the tension between that chaotic desire, like the 3:30 a.m. snake encounter, and the physical capacity to actually do it.
This is all deeply honest. But the peak of the physical trauma involved his eyesight, which he details in the eye doctor saga.
Yes. He visited the eye doctor an astonishing 6 times during his 40th year because his vision just kept changing, requiring new contacts.
He was wearing contacts, a nod to his vanity. He wouldn't dare be seen with glasses.
Right. And he was so frustrated and angry about the constant changes, internalizing it as a personal fault, I think, maybe because he felt his body was failing him uniquely.
And when he finally expressed his frustration, the doctor had to gently confirm that lots of humans have multiple eyesight changes when they turn 40.
So what Big Fatty perceived as this unique medical catastrophe was actually a universal, unavoidable signpost of middle age.
That must have been deeply humbling for someone who thrives on being unique and exceptional, even in his ruin.
Absolutely. It forced him to confront that he was just participating in a common human experience, not defying it.
Yeah.
And it pushed him toward a new level of self-acceptance, or at least self-acknowledgement.
Beyond the physical, the 40s brought a significant philosophical and aesthetic shift for BFO.
Mm-hmm.
He developed this new level of honesty and frankness, declaring that if someone asks him for his opinion, you're going to hear me out. His advice was simple and blunt. If you don't want it, don't ask.
That is the sound of someone who has just lost the patience required for pretense. The 40s provided him the confidence to stop filtering, which is, I mean, fantastic for his podcasting persona.
Of course.
This frankness is not just philosophical. It's a foundational element of the show's appeal. The listener knows they're getting unfiltered, raw honesty.
And he found a deep, almost childish satisfaction in vengeance.
Oh, he did. He thoroughly enjoyed watching. Friends who had teased him about turning 40 suffered the exact same physical issues later on. He found joy in payback.
This is where we must pause for a moment of critical inquiry. Big Fatty claims he values honesty and frankness, but doesn't finding satisfaction in a friend's physical suffering undermine the empathy he often shows his listeners? Is this justified Schadenfreude or merely childish payback?
I think it's the latter, but it's acknowledged payback. He's owning the pettiness.
That's true.
It's the human quality of, you made fun of me, now you suffer too, and that makes my suffering feel less unique. It connects right back to the doctor telling him his eye changes were normal. If everyone is miserable at 40, then Big Fatty's experience is validated.
That makes sense.
And Vera, who lives in LA, also reinforced the physical warnings, though she was focused on different ailments. She advised Gucci, who is 6 years younger than BFO, to watch out for the attack of the 40-some knees.
That is an unforgettable, perfect phrase for a truly common problem. The attack of the 40-some knees.
It's so good. It emphasizes that the body breaks down in these specific, kind of hilarious ways.
He also details the weight factor that compounded his discomfort.
Yes, he confirmed he gained back all the weight he had lost previously on Nutrisystem, admitting, I'm a big, fat slob again.
This added to the general misery of his 40s, making his aging skin feel uncomfortable. It's an honest, unvarnished look at the struggle for self-image in middle age.
Mm-hmm. They then pivot to how to spot age in others, especially in plastic surgery meccas like Los Angeles, where Vera lives.
Right. Vera's good at spotting cosmetic work, the nose jobs, the facelift.
But bad at guessing natural ages.
Big Fatty, however, looks for true age in specific, less manipulated areas.
He looks in the eyes, stating, "Your eyes never lie," and he also looks at people's hands.
He's looking for the authentic, unretouched markers of time. This really shows BFO's deep-seated aesthetic preference for authenticity, even if it's ruined authenticity. He sees manipulation as a form of pretense that he rejects.
And this observation leads BFO to share a piece of advice he learned and dished out in his 40s, a kind of inverted wisdom: seeing with your ears and listening with your eyes.
That phrase is a phenomenal piece of BFO philosophy.
It really is. It's a call for a more sensory, less superficial analysis of the world. It means don't just look at what's obvious, the face, the clothing. Listen for the subtext and watch for the unspoken cues that your ears might miss.
It's advice for critical engagement with the world, a necessity in the often performative spaces of the lifestyle community he navigates.
For sure. And Vera wraps up the decade by suggesting a healthier philosophical approach. Don't fear the 40s, but approach them with understanding, unlike those in LA who mutilate themselves trying to look young.
It's an acceptance of change, a concession that Big Fatty finally achieves, though grudgingly.
And the conversation concludes with a teaser that's crucial to the show's ongoing structure. They confirm they will be back next week to discuss the 50s.
This multi-part series provides that reliable, recurring biographical content that the listeners crave. It guarantees they'll tune in for the next installment.
It does.
So moving into Thursday, episode 80, we pivot abruptly from generational biography back to the core transactional structural elements of BFO, listener engagement, and gratitude.
And particularly the Amazon wish list. This is the moment where the listener can directly interact with the fat one.
First, Big Fatty reads a highly positive post from a new listener, Tim, in Tampa, who found the show via the Daily Purge on the Rob Nelson Live podcasting network. Tim praised the Annie Vera show for its honest look into the graying gay years and confessed he was now hooked.
And this is so important because it validates the structure of the RNL network. It shows the cross-promotion working exactly as intended.
Right, it's driving new listeners to the niche show based on strong thematic content like the aging discussion. New listeners are drawn in by the depth and then integrated into the chaos.
Exactly. He also shares a humorous complaint from Brian in Danbury asking how to stop AARP junk mail.
And BFO's solution was just to join AARP to stop the solicitation.
Which, of course, is both absurd and classically BFO, using confrontation, joining to solve a problem, junk mail, rather than avoidance. But the main segment of the day was the Amazon wish list, or wishes.
And Big Fatty admits he put up the list just to be funny, and more importantly, to show listeners how totally F up I am.
Right. He noted that the list included everything from pita bread to ham to a computer.
It's self-deprecation turned into a transactional performance art. It's him saying, look at my ridiculous needs and desires. I dare you to fulfill them.
And the gifts actually came. He received two items, which he noted was a delightful surprise, something rare and tangible in the abstract world of digital content.
The first was book. The Center Square, the Paul Lynn story, sent by Freddie. This gift is significant because it ties into BFO's historical media obsession.
Mm-hmm.
Big Fatty notes he is not a reader, but he loves Paul Lynn, a known fixture of classic game shows like Hollywood Squares.
And he adds that he had specifically been looking for a book about Charles Nelson Reilly.
Yes. Reinforcing his long-held obsession with these classic, unapologetically gay TV icons.
This isn't just trivia, it's cultural genealogy. Paul Lynn and Charles Nelson Reilly represent a very specific era of queer identity presented through mainstream entertainment, witty, slightly coded, but openly theatrical.
So by associating himself with these figures, BFO is placing his own performance within that legacy.
Exactly.
And the second gift was a pewter-colored necklace featuring two male symbols on a leather strap. It came from Dan's Jewelers, sent anonymously.
And this item is immediately incorporated into his future persona. He plans to debut it at the Big Gay Days event, integrating the listener gift directly into his public appearance and future travel plans.
The necklace is a physical symbol of the community's acknowledgement of his identity. It's a gift that speaks directly to the gay way theme.
By promising to wear it at a major upcoming event, he validates the anonymous sender and makes the listener a tangible part of his public life.
The voice letters segment on Thursday provided a few gems, starting with Kathy from South Dakota.
Oh.
She called, not to offer praise, but to question the practicality of his wish list, specifically why he needed to buy Scotch tape off Amazon instead of just using Costco.
And she even offered to send $15 cash for the tape.
She did. And Big Fatty jokes that this offer made it the most feff that wish list ever.
The seemingly minor interaction is so key. That level of hyper-specific listener engagement, arguing over the utility of Costco versus Amazon Scotch tape, is exactly why the BFO community works.
They don't just passively listen.
No, they actively critique his consumer habits and logistics, showing a familiarity that borders on intimate friendship.
Then we hear from Mr. Tim Cormall, the patron saint of the BFO, who asked if Big Fatty ever went to the Automat, referencing a past song lyric.
And this question prompts a fantastic dive into deep personal history, connecting the chaotic Big Fatty online persona to his highly structured past self.
Big Fatty confirmed he had been to the Automat once in his life, and he uses this question to detail a story from his childhood.
He went in the seventh grade when he was the sergeant of the safety patrols in Georgia.
Think about that title, Sergeant of the Safety Patrols. This is a young Big Fatty, defined by structure, rules, and responsibility.
The exact opposite of the adult who encourages explicit pictures.
Exactly. And as a reward for their service, they were essentially the crossing guards maintaining rigid order.
Mm-hmm.
The safety patrols went on a trip to Washington, D.C. and New York, where they visited the Automat in NYC.
The Automat, for those unfamiliar, was this revolutionary vending machine restaurant concept, popular in the early to mid-20th century.
It's a phenomenal piece of personal history that links his past life of rigid structure, the safety patrol sergeant, to a very specific, now defunct cultural artifact, the Automat.
The contrast between the rigid rules of the safety patrol and the subsequent chaos of his adult life is just so stark, but he embraces both halves of his history.
He then wrapped up the episode with crucial pop culture updates, which are structural non-negotiables for the show. These are his anchors to the mainstream world.
He noted that Christy Yamaguchi had won Dancing with the Stars. He also alerted listeners to record the new Million Dollar Password on Sunday nights.
And of course, a personal congratulations to David Archuleta for winning American Idol, proudly declaring that this was Big Fatty's choice always.
It confirms his dedication to tracking the winners and losers of the major reality TV shows, which is a modern parallel to his obsession with classic game show hosts.
And the Memory Lane music selection for Thursday was the theme from The Real McCoys.
Right. He provides meticulous details. The show was a sitcom that aired on ABC and then CBS, running from 1957 to 1963.
The premise revolved around a mountain family from West Virginia who moved to California to become dirt farmers. He lists the characters with archival precision.
He does. Grandpa Amos, played by Walter Brennan, famous for the phrase "con sunnit," grandson Luke, Luke's bride Kate, teenage sister Hashi, little Luke, and the hired help Papini.
He ties the nostalgia back to his physical persona, noting that he used to do an impersonation of Grandpa Amos's signature walk, which involved pumping his arms down.
This is the kind of obscure physical trivia that his longtime listeners appreciate. It's a shared memory of classic media that serves as a collective cultural shorthand for the BFO community.
Which brings us to Friday. We finish the week with episode 81. They kick off to the Memorial Day observed weekend.
And the themes are chaotic leisure and highly explicit requests, a perfect encapsulation of the BFO tightrope walk.
It really is. The episode aired on Thursday, May 22nd, setting the stage for the big holiday weekend. Big Fatty confirms his off time. He will be off Monday from the coal mine.
The coal mine, his day job, which is the source of his financial stability and the necessary constraint that licenses his weekend chaos.
He jokes about his potential schedule. Going to Patrick's Pub Friday, Saturday, and Sunday and being a drunken stupor.
It's a self-aware performance of excess, knows the audience expects the chaos, and he delivers the tease for it.
He also teases a crucial logistical update for the upcoming Gay Days trip in Orlando, mentioning he will likely post his packing list over at the Gay Days log blog.
And poses the rhetorical question, who want to see what Big Fatty's packing?
And the question immediately transitions into a moment of radical, explicit listener engagement. This is where the show pushes boundaries that few other podcasts would dare cross.
Mm-hmm.
Big Fatty publicly thanks a listener named Sky for sending a picture of what he is packing, a picture of penises.
This is classic BFO unfiltered boundary-pushing content delivered in the same casual conversational tone he used to discuss the Automat. He treats explicit, often fetishized content with the same structural importance as TV trivia.
He then extends an open invitation, encouraging any listener, or those who sleep with men, to send him pictures of penises.
Stating, I'm always happy to. Give it the once-over.
This open invitation normalizes and encourages the contribution of highly explicit personal material to the show's content pool. It's a calculated strategy for building community intimacy.
By sharing these images, or at least acknowledging them, he reinforces the idea that BFO is a completely non-judgmental space, where even the most intimate parts of life are welcomed as content.
But despite the explicit nature of the show, it is immediately balanced by the cultural structural element, the memory lane music.
Right. The hint for Friday's theme was Gertrude and Heathcliff.
The theme was Holiday for Strings, the signature music from the Red Skelton Show.
And Big Fatty provides the essential history, a staple of American TV from the early 1950s through the early 1970s, mainly on CBS. Again, he's reinforcing his obsession with classic, stable, structured television.
He ran through the recurring characters, displaying his extensive knowledge of the show's history. George Appleby, the perpetually henpecked husband.
Deadeye, the inept sheriff.
Yep.
And San Fernando Red, the shady real estate agent.
And, of course, the clue. Gertrude and Heathcliff, the two seagulls bit. Red Skelton performed this bit by crossing his eyes and sticking his thumbs under his armpits for wings.
And Big Fatty mentions Freddy the Freeloader, the tramp character reminiscent of EMT Kelly, who featured in a silent pantomime spot. This deep dive into classic comedy offers a nostalgic, almost wholesome contrast to the penis pictures.
The show's famous closing ritual is also detailed. Skelton always closed, sincerely looking at the camera, saying good night and may God bless, and waving four fingers.
This highbrow cultural nostalgia provides the necessary, almost wholesome framework for the lowbrow chaos delivered earlier in the episode.
This balancing act is just so crucial, isn't it? The sincerity of Red Skelton's sign-off mirrors the sincerity of BFO's own community commitment, despite the outrageous content.
It absolutely does.
Finally, Big Fatty wrapped the week with a community shout-out, wishing a very happy birthday to Brian from Boston, who is recognized as the BFO's resident historian.
And he ends the week with one final tease, joking that he might share his own drunken exploits on Monday.
That final tease is the promise of more content, more chaos, and more truth. He's setting the hook for next week, ensuring that the listener returns to hear the inevitable confession of whatever drunken stupor status he achieves over the long Memorial Day weekend. So let's bring it all back. This week of May 2008 shows Big Fatty online at peak operational efficiency. We saw the chaotic collision of his personal life.
The 3:30 a.m. snake encounter, the fictional litigation with Connie McCumley.
Perfectly fused with the biographical honesty of the 40s discussion with Annie Vera Charles.
And all of that deeply personal chaos was licensed and stabilized by the show's rigid structural anchors. We had the daily weekday format, the meticulous tracking of listener gifts and network peers.
And the reliable flow of obscure TV trivia, often rooted in his childhood memories of structure, like the Automat story or the safety patrols.
The key insight here is the paradox of his success. Big Fatty uses his stability, his steady job at the coal mine, his disciplined financial management, the rigid schedule of The Daily Show, to create a safe platform for the explicit and vulnerable chaos.
He uses the structure to license the outrageous content, like detailing his physical decline or encouraging listeners to send pictures of penises.
That commitment to the routine makes the outrageous content feel trustworthy. The audience trusts him because they know no matter how wild the disclosure, the memory lane music, and the structured greeting will be there tomorrow.
The structure is what makes the vulnerability palatable and ultimately sticky for his audience.
Right.
Which leaves a provocative thought for you, the listener. Big Fatty built this dedicated community by turning the most specific, sometimes embarrassing, details of his life, his 40s, physical decline, his desire for a pewter necklace, the precise time of his encounter with Snake into consistent content. What personal, embarrassing, or specific detail of your own life could you commit to sharing consistently to build your own dedicated community or personal brand?
That structured vulnerability is the secret sauce. You have to give people something specific to hold on to, even if it's just an argument over whether to buy scotch tape from Amazon or Costco. Thank you for joining us for this deep exploration into the BFO archives.
I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
Crucially, remember to tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, The Early Years. We hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the early years.
And be sure to check out BigFatOnline.com and call the Voicelet number at 206-337-1438 and give me your good gosh and gamey. This has been a presentation of the RNL Podcasting Network.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the early years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.